I think I'm right about being on slide six. We talked about five, right? The bone one. Okay, good. In slide six, we are looking at an important dichotomy. I don't know why I can't see the markers. A dichotomy is a two-part thing. And the dichotomy we're looking at here is the dichotomy of cell types, meaning that in all of biology, there are two major categories of cells, non-overlapping categories. So any given cell and any given organism really is in one of the two categories only. There's no overlap. And those two categories of cells are prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic. So notice what they share here, these words. They share the karyo root, which is a Greek root that means kernel or core. Specifically with respect to a cell, what karyo refers to, if it has one, is the cell nucleus, which we'll have much more to say about. But pro, as a prefix, means before. And therefore, prokaryotic cells are named for the fact that they existed. They were the first cells to come into existence. And they existed long before the cell nucleus came into existence, evolutionarily. There are still prokaryotic cells. In fact, the vast majority of cells alive now are prokaryotic. They still don't have a nucleus. But then there are cells like the ones making up our bodies that are eukaryotic, and the EU, pronounced U prefix, means good or true. So eukaryotic literally means true nucleus, having a true nucleus. Now, true in this respect refers to the fact that a nucleus, if it is there in a cell, is an example not only of an organelle, like we were talking about last time in the hierarchy of biological organization, but it, more specifically, the nucleus is a membrane-bounded organelle. And so let me clarify, now that I've used that phrase, that there are two very similar sounding phrases used in biology that are not interchangeable. They mean different things. And those phrases are membrane-bounded and membrane-bound. It's a little bit confusing terminology because bound, in one sense of the word, is a past tense. It's a past tense of bind, which means to tie or to join. So bound means tied or joined. Membrane bound, therefore, means tied to a membrane. It's connected to a membrane. And later in the term, we'll talk about membrane bound proteins, proteins that are attached to a membrane. That's not the phrase I used, though, earlier to describe a cell nucleus. A cell nucleus is a membrane bounded organelle. And in this case, bound means, is a verb meaning to form a boundary with. And therefore, bounded is the past tense of that. And membrane bounded means enclosed by a membrane, not attached to a membrane. You see the difference? Well, not all organelles are membrane-bounded, but a cell nucleus, if it exists in a cell, is an example of a membrane-bounded organelle. And that is the basis for why eukaryotic cells are called that. It's the etymological or language-based basis. Only eukaryotic cells have a cell nucleus. A prokaryotic cell does not have a nucleus, and that's why it's called prokaryotic, but it's actually more rigorous than that. Not only does a prokaryotic cell not have a nucleus, it also doesn't have any other membrane-bounded organelles. And those other membrane-bounded organelles we're going to go through one by one as a survey in another chapter. Things like endoplasmic reticulum, mitochondria, those are all membrane-bounded organelles. No prokaryotic cell has those. Now, every cell, by definition of being a cell, has a membrane that defines the cell, the boundary between it and the rest of the universe, and that membrane is the plasma membrane, or some books will call it the cell membrane. The plasma membrane really defines the cell. And when we talked about the fact that the structural bare minimum for being an organism is that you have to have at least one cell, because for life to occur, life is that collection of chemical reactions that occur that we call metabolism. Those reactions have to have a special place to occur. A little test tube, I think I used as an analogy. That's what a cell is, and it's able to be a test tube separated from the surroundings because of the plasma membrane. So every cell has a plasma membrane. But a prokaryotic cell doesn't have any additional membranes. Its plasma membrane is its only membrane. And the prokaryotic cell, as you see here, is the smaller one in the upper right. Since it only has a plasma membrane and no other membranes inside, that means it is not compartmentalized. There is just one compartment inside a prokaryotic cell. The whole interior is one compartment, like a one-room house, basically. On the other hand, a eukaryotic cell is compartmentalized because it has not only a nucleus, but other membrane-bounded organelles as well. It has multiple membranes, and each of those membranes forms a little sub-compartment within the overall cell interior. The conspicuous organelle here, and the one that's the basis for distinction between prokaryotic and eukaryotic linguistically, is the purple in this image, nucleus. And so there is a separate membrane, separate from the plasma membrane, a membrane called the nuclear envelope that defines the nucleus itself. That's why it is a true nucleus, because it has its own membrane. The prokaryotic cell, like I said, is just one compartment, so all of the stuff that's inside the cell collectively is called the cytoplasm. Cyte means cell, and plasm means stuff. So it's literally the cell stuff in a prokaryotic cell. But there are multiple compartments in a eukaryotic cell. So it has its own cytoplasm, but it also has other stuff. For instance, we don't call the stuff that's inside the cell, inside the nucleus, cytoplasm, because that's a different compartment. We call all of that stuff collectively the nucleoplasm, stuff of the nucleus. All right, so the membrane not only subdivides, it separates chemical solutions, meaning the aqueous solution or water-based solution that's inside the nucleus can be chemically different from the chemical solution that's outside of the nucleus but still inside the cell. Okay, now you also see, and there is a range of sizes in both prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells. So this is just kind of an average. But on average, a prokaryotic cell is only about 1/10 as big in each of the three dimensions. So it's 1/10 as tall, 1/10 as deep, 1/10 as wide. And therefore, in terms of volume, it's only 1/1,000. The volume. You could fit roughly 1,000 of these little ones inside this in three dimensions. But there is exceptions. There are some extraordinarily large cells, some extraordinarily small cells. That's just an average. We'll be talking much more about organelles in their own chapter. Now let's go to 7, which still has to do with cells, and specifically cell theory, which I think I kind of offhandedly mentioned last time. I might have told you that an important part of cell theory is that cells come only from pre-existing cells, at least nowadays, and it's been that way for 4 billion years or so. The original cells did come into existence from just molecules that were accumulating on the Earth's surface. We'll talk about that later. That's a totally different set of conditions from what happened, what we live in now. So cells don't just no longer pop into existence. Cells come from cells that already are there and give rise to new cells, and that usually occurs by cell division, meaning one cell splits, which effectively ends its own life. You know, it's a little bit different from a woman giving birth. She usually is still alive after that process, and there's a new individual. But when a cell splits, the original cell is no longer there, and in its place you have two cells. And so that's the vast majority of how new cells are created, by cell division. Here we're looking at actually an exception to it at first, in slide 7, because for sexual species, which we're examples of, plants, fungi, animals, we're sexual species, there is cell fusion that can happen, which is, in a sense, the opposite of cell division, right? Instead of one cell splitting into two, you have two cells, gametes, or sex cells, fusing into one cell, creating the zygote that each of you started out as. So that happens in certain situations, but once that zygote is formed, which is the beginning of you officially, then the normal situation of cell division takes place. You don't last as a zygote very long. Then you're two cells, and four cells, eight cells, and so on. Now you're about 100 trillion cells because of cell division. Slide 8. Well, I probably wouldn't have to have this labeled for you to know that this is a picture of a little piece of DNA. It's probably the most famous chemical in the world nowadays. And we will spend almost half of the term studying DNA in one form or another, basically the second half, or after exam 3. Exams 4 and 5 will be all about DNA. So I'll have much more to say about it eventually, but for this chapter, let me just say that it is an informational molecule. It carries information. It, chemically speaking, is a polymer, which means it's a large molecule built out of a bunch of subunits hooked together. And those subunits are called nucleotides. And since there are different kinds of nucleotides, it's a little bit like building a necklace out of beads, where you have four choices of beads. The A's, T's, C's, and G's that you see here are like four different kinds of beads. And the information that I'm talking about exists as the specific sequence of nucleotides, which can be any sequence. Just like you could, if I give you thousands or millions of each of the four kinds of beads and tell you to make any necklace you want, there's all kinds of possibilities. But each specific sequence is the specific information that that molecule is carrying. And we'll study the particulars later, but the information that's contained in DNA is used indirectly by organisms for how to build proteins. We routinely say or think that DNA gives us our traits, organisms in general, not just humans. DNA is certainly important for our traits, but it doesn't directly give us our traits. What directly give organisms their traits are the specific kinds of proteins that those organisms are able to make. In other words, you look the way you do, you smell the way you do, you think the way you do because of the particular proteins that your body makes. Because proteins do all the important jobs in cells. But even though there's no limit to the number of proteins that can be produced, no organism is able to make any protein unless it has specific instructions for how to do that. and therefore an organism can only make for its lifetime the kinds of proteins for which genes tell it the instructions for how to build. Unless your DNA gets changed, which you could do artificially, you know, that's what genetic engineering does. It gives new traits to organisms because it gives them the instructions for how to build different proteins from what they naturally could do. So we'll talk a lot more about DNA later, but that's just an introduction. Like I said, this chapter is all over the place. That brings us to 9. And as you see, 9 features schematic representations of 2 major categories of feedback. Negative feedback and positive feedback. Now, feedback is called feedback because something in a process feeds back to an earlier part in the process. It feeds back. If you recall the first slide, I think it was, we looked at the 7 major characteristics that living things share. One of which was regulation. And I mentioned homeostasis, maintenance of a relatively stable environment within an organism, which keeps an organism from dying because it keeps variables within tolerable limits. That requires regulation. And the mechanism for that regulation is feedback, but not both of these feedback mechanisms. Organisms feature both negative and positive feedback mechanisms, but positive feedback is comparatively rare. The vast majority of feedback mechanisms in living organisms is negative feedback. And that's because negative feedback is the only kind of feedback that can ever lead to homeostasis. In fact, this is why it's named negative feedback. If you haven't already figured out, I would like you to try and think about words, the meanings of words. It's really helpful. Negative is the adjective of the verb negate. And negate means get rid of, right? To eliminate. Well, what negative feedback seeks to eliminate is something we call the error. So let me give you a few definitions when it comes to feedback. In any given feedback mechanism, there is some sort of variable. Now, there's all kinds of different variables, but any given mechanism will operate on one variable at a time. A variable, by definition, is anything that whose value can vary, right? There's all kinds of variables, like pH, for instance. But a very familiar one, easy to understand, is temperature. So that's a variable. Its value can be anything in any given moment. It's not constant. All right? Despite the fact that the variable can vary in value, the cell would like the value to be a specific value. And we call that specific value the set point. This is entirely analogous to the set point that you put into a thermostat to keep temperature close to your desired set point in the room. All right, so the set point is a goal in a sense. The actual value of the variable at any given moment, though, is almost never exactly at set point. Just like room temperature is almost never exactly what you set the temperature to be with a thermostat. It's usually a little bit above or a little bit below because it's moving all the time. Right? So almost always there is some difference, some non-zero difference between set point and variable value. And whatever that difference is, we call that the error in the system. If the error is zero, that means at the moment no changes need to be made, right? Because the value of the variable is exactly at set point. That's just rare. There's usually some error. But notice that error can occur in either of two directions. Using the temperature example, it can be too warm or it can be too cool. Either one is an error. Okay, well, negative feedback is called this because in either of those two cases, in either of the directions of the error, whether it's too high or too low, in other words, a positive error or a negative error, negative feedback can help because what is being negated in negative feedback is the error itself. In other words, if the temperature is above set point, negative feedback will cause things to happen that'll bring it back down towards set point. But it's the same exact kind of mechanism, negative feedback, that will bring it back up if it's too low. I don't want you, in other words, to think that positive feedback is for one type of error and negative feedback is for the other type of error. That's not true. Negative feedback works in both directions. Positive feedback will never work. It's the opposite of negative feedback, as the name implies. But what that means is positive feedback will always make the error, whatever it is at the moment, even bigger. If the temperature were too high, it would make it even higher. And if it's too low, it would make it even lower. So it drives the variable, positive feedback, drives the variable away from set point. And obviously that can never lead to homeostasis, right? Homeostasis is trying to maintain it within limits. And this is why positive feedback is rare. It can never lead to homeostasis. So it can be either pathological, you know, like if my arm gets hacked off, obviously I'm going to lose some blood. And that is going to immediately reduce my blood pressure because I've lost a lot of blood. My body's going to try to get the blood pressure back up by working my heart harder, which is going to cause even more blood to get pumped out of my missing arm.
That'd be positive feedback.
Yeah, and it's an important point about positive feedback is that all positive feedback mechanisms are temporary. In this case, it would be temporary because I would die. But even normal positive feedback mechanisms have to be temporary because they're non-homeostatic. I said they're rare. There are plenty of examples, but almost all biology textbooks use the same positive feedback mechanism just because I think people understand it well from living, and that is parturition or childbirth. So what happens here, to explain why it's positive feedback, is that at labor, the fetus, which is usually upside down in the uterus, so head pointing at the cervix, the opening of the uterus, feet toward the top at the fundus, that head is starting to stretch the cervix, and the muscular uterus can stretch, but the body senses that stretching. So there are nervous impulses sent because of that stretching to the brain. The brain responds by releasing oxytocin, a hormone. That oxytocin, like any hormone, gets delivered into the bloodstream. So it reaches all of the tissues in the body, but almost none of the tissues know it's even there because they don't have the receptor for oxytocin. The uterus does, though. So the uterus responds to the oxytocin by contracting the muscle that makes up the uterine wall, especially at the fundus, the blind end at the top where the feet are. And that pushes it downward toward the cervix a little more, which makes the head stretch the cervix a little more, which causes an even stronger impulse to be sent to the brain, which causes even more oxytocin to be released, causing the uterus to contract even harder, so it's building, right? It's positive feedback. And it's temporary because if everything goes well, fetus pops out, becomes officially a baby, and hopefully the woman survives. That hasn't always been the case, especially historically. But once that feedback mechanism, that positive feedback mechanism, does its job, immediately normal negative feedback mechanisms will come into place to restore homeostasis and therefore keep the woman alive. Oh, just to explain these schematic representations, this is using biochemical pathways, which we'll study later. These aren't real examples. The A, B, C, and D just represent some chemicals. But A gets turned into B, which gets turned into C, which gets turned into D. And so you would run this pathway because you need D, whatever it is, for some reason. But if D starts building up, then the error here is you have too much D on hand. And D itself would go back and shut down further production of D. It's negative feedback. On the other hand, W through Z, when Z builds up here, Z is causing even more Z to be built. That's positive feedback. Ten. We're looking here at some classification. Humans have been classifying organisms for thousands of years simply because we notice our surroundings. And we have classified things different ways over the years. But here we're using a bear as an example. But notice the top listing of names there. You might have heard of kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species before. Those are all examples of taxa. The singular of taxa is taxon. Each one is a taxon. That's a real general word. A taxon is simply a group of things. So class is a taxon, family is a taxon, and so on. This is a hierarchical arrangement. It's a nested arrangement, right? Because a phylum contains a certain number of classes within it. Each class within it then contains a certain number of orders and so on. Each one of these, as you go from right to left, each one of these taxa gets smaller, more and more restrictive. Only a smaller number of species belong to it. Until you finally get two species, which is only that species. But genus is the next one up. And organisms can be referred to by their so-called scientific name, which is also called a binomial, a word that means two names. The binomial for an organism is simply a listing of its genus to which it belongs, followed by its species to which it belongs. All right? And there are, to use a binomial correctly, the genus name should always be capitalized. The species name should never be capitalized. Both the genus and the species name should always be italicized. Just like for the bear here. This specific bear belongs to the genus Ursus. It is the species Americanus. So its binomial is Ursus Americanus, spelled all in italics, but only the genus name capitalized. For us, for instance, we belong to the genus called Homo. Now, most genera, that's the plural of genus, most genera contain several different species that are alive still. That's not true for our genus. There have been several different species in the same genus as we, but they have all gone extinct. We're the only ones left. And we're on our way out too. But that's our genus name, Homo. Our species name is Sapiens, and therefore our binomial is Homo sapiens. Okay? The right edge of this. I mean, you've probably heard of kingdoms, right? You know about that the animals make up a kingdom, for instance. That's a big taxon. But what you see here is that it's not the biggest taxon. Kingdoms used to be, though. In the early days, way before me, there were really only two kingdoms. And this is before we knew anything about microscopic organisms or anything. We lumped everything into two categories, either animal or plant. Didn't realize that fungi have nothing to do with plants, for instance. They came from the ground, they're plants. So there were two kingdoms and nothing bigger than kingdoms. By the time I came into existence, and I think it was like fifth grade or so where I first learned classification, there were still nothing bigger than kingdoms, but there were five kingdoms by then. Well, now there are many more than five kingdoms, plus kingdoms are no longer even the biggest taxa. There are bigger groups that we recognize, and those are called domains. Nothing so far is bigger than a domain. And what we see in slide 11 is that there are exactly three domains. So three domains exhaustively describe the organisms, or exhaustively contain. What I mean by exhaustively is that no organism is outside of all three domains. Any organism is in one domain only. There's no overlap between them. And I'm not talking about just the organisms alive. I'm talking about all organisms that have ever existed are in one domain or another. None is in two at once. And notice that one of these domains, well, the names are bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. One of these domains is called eukarya, and not accidentally, of course. It's called eukarya because the domain called eukarya includes the eukaryotic organisms. I use these words to describe cells, but any given organism, no matter whether it has one cell or multiple cells, however many cells it has, they're all the same type. There aren't organisms that are mixtures of prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells, is what I'm saying. We are eukaryotic organisms. We can use a form of the word called either prokaryote or eukaryote to refer to an organism that is eukaryotic or prokaryotic. We are eukaryotes. The domain eukarya is named for the fact that it includes all eukaryotic organisms that have ever existed and nothing else. There's no non-eukaryote in eukarya. All right, so that includes us, fungi, plants, protists, those are all within eukarya. Now, I just earlier told you about the cell type dichotomy. So that in terms of cell types, there are two groups, prokaryotic and eukaryotic. But there's three domains. Eukarya that we just talked about, but there is no domain called prokarya. So if an organism is not a member of eukarya, that means it's not a eukaryote. Therefore, it must be a prokaryote, right? But what I'm saying here is that prokaryotic organisms are separated into two separate domains, bacteria and archaea. So each individual prokaryote is either a bacteria member or an archaea member. And it's probably obvious that domain bacteria contains specifically the bacteria. By far the most successful organisms of all time. And that will no doubt continue to be true. Archaea contains only prokaryotic organisms as well, but the prokaryotes, only the prokaryotes that are not bacteria. Now, if you were to put a bacterium and an archaean side by side under a light microscope, you wouldn't really be able to tell the difference as far as what you're looking at is concerned. But at the molecular level, there are, and the evolutionarily the evolutionary level, there are important big differences between these two domains, which is why we're justified in putting them in their own domains. And as a matter of fact, even though outwardly looking, bacteria and archaea seem very similar, when you actually examine them molecularly, domain archaea and domain eukarya, which includes us, are more similar to each other than either one is to bacteria. But any given organism is in one and only one of these domains. Okay, 12. There is a huge variety of life. You already know that. Bacteria are very different from sequoia trees, which are very different from algae, and so on. Despite the huge variety of organisms, which has come to be because of natural selection, there is still a lot of things that seemingly distantly related organisms share. And that's what this example is. Here we have a paramecium, which is a unicellular protist. It's in eukarya like we are, but it's not very closely related to us. You have to go way back in time to get the common ancestor to both of us. And in the right, we have windpipe cells, the trachea of a human. Each of these cells is ciliated. You see one cilium from each. Cilium is a word that means hair. It's not real hair. Only mammals make real hair. But they look like little hairy projections from the cell. And despite the fact that our common ancestor is a long time ago, if you examine by cross-section the molecular architecture within a cilium from each of these two cells, they're effectively identical. Because it's an example of something that happened accidentally, like all mutations do, that create new versions of DNA, new traits. But that was just so successful that it hasn't changed much since then. Okay, so this is just one of the bits of information pointing to the fact that all organisms descended from a common ancestor. The first, or I should say the last, successful original cells that form the actual trunk of the overall tree of life. All right, 13. I talked just barely about natural selection. Here we have an example of how it works, and hopefully it'll be more clear after this. We're looking at two different populations here. One population, they're both animal populations, but the one population is the prey population, the bugs, and the other population is the predator population, the birds. And the blackness here isn't just for aesthetic effect. It represents the fact that wherever this is that these live is fairly dark. The background that they live on is dark. The predator, the bird, well, let me start over. The bugs, the members of this population, the individuals, like those in any real population, are not genetically identical, and they therefore have different traits from individual to individual. That's true of all of us, true of any given population, and it's true for all kinds of different characteristics. The only one we care about in this example, to make it clear, is the coloration of the bugs. There could be other things about them that are different from individual to individual, but we're just ignoring that. And so you can see that some of them are darker colored, some of them are lighter colored. And that's just a random chance, you know, whatever genetic hand you get dealt as this bug species is going to determine whether you're darker or lighter. That's just natural variation within a population. The bird wants to eat the bugs and doesn't give a damn about what color they are. It doesn't prefer a light one over a dark one or vice versa. Neither one is more nutritional than the other. The bird just wants to spend as little energy as possible finding its food so that it won't run out of energy and die. So it's going to snap at whichever bug it sees first. Since these bugs, though, live on a dark background, the easiest ones for the bird to see are the ones that are light-colored because of the contrast. Anything that moves is going to be more obvious to the bird if it's light than if it's dark. Yes, it's going to eat some dark ones now and then because it'll see them, but it's going to eat a lot more light ones because they're so obvious. And so what this means is that the ones that get eaten, of course, are dead. They have DNA that instructs the cells to make proteins that make them dark. That DNA will not get passed on if they're dead, because it only gets passed on if the organism reproduces. Right? So but on the other hand, a bug that's dark will have the DNA instructing how to be dark, and it will have a much higher chance statistically of surviving to the point of being able to reproduce. And therefore, it will pass on the genes for darkness to the next generation. That's evolution. It occurs between generations, not within the lifetime of an individual. And it's specifically evolution by natural selection, because nature is selecting for the ones that have the advantage, in this case, camouflage. All right? It's evolution, though, because the makeup of the next population is different from what it was in the previous one. That next generation is going to have a higher fraction of dark-colored individuals than light-colored individuals. It has evolved, in other words. And it will get better and better. Notice that it evolves in such a way that the population is adapting. It's adaptive evolution. All right? Now, this is very similar to a famous real-world example. There's thousands and thousands of examples of evolution. But an early one that was famous was from 1800s, I think, in England. It's the same kind of thing, except the butterflies lived. Moths lived on light-colored barks of trees.
Birch.
Right, naturally light-colored. But then the Industrial Revolution came along, because of the lightness, most of them in the population were light. The Industrial Revolution came along and humans burnt so much coal and other stuff that the bark got sooty. So the environment changed from light to dark, and that changes the selection pressures. Now it's disadvantageous to be light because you stick out. And so evolution caused the new populations to be mostly dark, because they had the advantage then. Same thing is happening here, though. Just keep in mind that environments change, and that causes evolutionary change. All right, 14. These finches are shown in an arrangement that we call a phylogenetic tree, because it's like branches of a tree. Phylogeny is one kind of classification. It's not how we started out classifying things when I was talking about lumping them into either animal or plant groups. That really was just based on what things look like to us. You know, like a bat and a bird both fly. Well, let's put them together. Phylogeny doesn't do that. It doesn't matter what things look like to humans. Phylogeny groups things based on their shared ancestry. And therefore, the groupings result in these tree-like structures called phylogenetic trees. Each branch point in a tree is called a node. And biologically, each node in a phylogenetic tree represents a speciation event. in which one lineage of organisms splits into two different species, two different lineages. And so you have a common ancestor here, which is a member of the lineage that is the ancestor to all of these that have split from it. But this is just a tiny piece of the overall tree of life. This isn't even all birds, and therefore it's not even all animals, and therefore it's not even all eukarya. What I'm saying, though, is that there is one huge tree of life that includes everything. And that common ancestor, in that case, the trunk of the tree, would be those successful cells that came on the scene 4.5 billion years ago and is the ancestor to all of us. Now to 15. This final topic in this catch-all chapter is about the scientific method. And scientific method obviously is related to science, which is a belief system. There's another dichotomy. There are two fundamentally different belief systems. A belief system has to do with belief, obviously. But science is belief based on evidence. That's a requirement. In other words, if you believe something, that's up to you, but you're not scientifically believing it unless you have evidence for that, whatever you're believing. Faith, on the other hand, is a completely different kind of belief system. Faith is belief that is not based on evidence. You can believe whatever you want to be faithful, since there doesn't have to be any evidence for it. It's belief not based on evidence, and in fact, faith is sometimes belief despite evidence to the contrary. You still believe it because you want to, but not in science. So there might be something that you can think of kind of in a scientific way that would make sense, like me earlier saying there's almost certainly other organisms out there just because of the numbers involved. Even though that makes sense, I can't simply believe that scientifically. It has to be demonstrated. And that's why we still have the biosphere only as big as it is. Faithfully, I could say, yeah, there's organisms out there, but that's not science. The scientific method is a set of steps, in a sense, but it really just, it's logic when you get down to it. First of all, it starts with observations. Humans just notice things about their surroundings. And this doesn't have to be something that you can see. It often is, because humans are such visually oriented animals, but it's observations don't have to be visual. Anyway, we notice things about the world, and since we're curious animals, we wonder why things are the way they are. This is a very simple example. The observation is that the flashlight doesn't work. So she's saying, why is that? Questions naturally beg for explanations. All right? So observations lead to questions. Questions lead to something that students, about half of students, switch these two things I'm going to talk about and get them wrong. They're similar, but they're importantly different. One is hypothesis, the other is prediction. A hypothesis is an explanation for some observation. And it's stated in such a way that you are saying it's true, even though you know it might not be. And you can kind of tell by the language. Because is a big word in a hypothesis. In other words, you would say, in this example, the flashlight does not work because the battery's dead. That's a hypothesis, and notice that I stated it as though it's true, even though it might not be. It's a declarative sentence. A prediction, on the other hand, usually has if or will in it. A prediction says what would happen if the hypothesis is actually true. But a hypothesis, an explanation, logically leads to a prediction, right? If that hypothesis is true, then you should see such and such. That's the prediction part. If then. So the prediction corresponding to hypothesis one, the dead battery, is that if you replace the batteries, then the flashlight will light again. There are two different hypotheses shown here, but obviously there's other possible hypotheses. There's no limit to the number of hypotheses. And logically, it makes sense that only one of them is correct, however many you have, but all of them are stated in a way that you assume they're correct until you test it. That's the whole idea of the method. Because the next step, after you have corresponding predictions that correspond to hypotheses, is that you set up an experiment. This is what makes it experimental, science. You set up an experiment in such a way that it would test whether a given prediction corresponding to a hypothesis will come true. All right? And then you run the experiment. Well, in this case, the experiment for hypothesis one is simply to replace the battery. And when that's done, notice that it did not light. If a prediction fails to come true in an experiment, what does that tell us? Right, the hypothesis is wrong. So it's possible to disprove a hypothesis, just logically. What happens if a prediction comes true? Not necessarily, no. If a prediction comes true, then that tells us the corresponding hypothesis might be correct. In this simple example, let's just say that the real problem is that there was an electrical discontinuity, a loose wire. And when you conducted the experiment for the burnout bulb, what you really did was take a good bulb out, put a new one in, and in so doing, you somehow jiggled the wire correctly and got it connected again. So it lights, and you can't say, I mean, you would think that that means the problem was the burnout light bulb, but it actually wasn't. And this is one of multiple reasons why we never run just one experiment to test a hypothesis. We do many replicates. And then other scientists in the world do the same experiment in their own labs many times. And then eventually, if you have a hypothesis that always gets supported because the predictions always come true all over the world, eventually we call those things facts. Now, we don't know anything really for sure, but it's logical to believe scientifically the things that are demonstrated over and over. You know, so that's what facts really are. Things like gravity and evolution. You can do the gravity experiment as many times as you want, but the apple is not going to fall upward. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
What's the difference between the facts and laws?
Well, theories and laws are just different degrees of strengths of these. Eventually, you know, things like evolution, fact. But even though things can seem convincing as hell, I'm glad you brought this up, because another thing about science is that if we suddenly learn that we've been wrong, we're not allowed to continue to believe that. You would be in faith, you can believe whatever you want. But in science, if you're acting scientifically and there's evidence disproving what we thought was true all along, you have to get rid of that. And that happens every once in a while. For instance, Newtonian mechanics describes how objects move in the universe. And it's still being taught because at the macroscopic level, it's good enough, it's close enough to the truth. You'll get a good enough answer. But then, 100 years ago, roughly, came quantum mechanics. We realized that Newtonian mechanics actually doesn't work when you get down to the small scale. And so quantum mechanics is the new truth. Newtonian mechanics is no longer true, but we still teach it because it's a hell of a lot easier to teach students than quantum mechanics. They eventually, if they go on, will learn that what they've been taught is actually wrong when you get down to it. But that's an example of, you know, sometimes we have to shed what are long-held beliefs in science. I think that's the last slide of the chapter. Yes, it is.